Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The proper quote, actually, is what's good for the country is good for General Motors, not the other way around. Why tell you that on this Tuesday? Because car sales were out this morning, and they were very, very good for GM and everybody else. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 3rd of June. Great, as always, to have you with us. And how good were May car sales, you ask? So good that we are buying as many cars as we did back in 2008, before the bottom fell out and the bankruptcies and the bailouts and all the rest of that unpleasantness. Everybody beat expectations. Ford, GM, Chrysler, and a bunch of others as well. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer gets us going.
Champagne corks are popping at car dealerships across the country. Even high-end dealers are celebrating. George Liang is president of DCH Auto Group, which has showrooms in four states.
Both BMW and Audi are up quite a bit so far this year versus last year.
Kelly Blue Book says car sales nationwide were up about 11% over May of last year for all kinds of reasons. Dealers advertise big Memorial Day sales.
Mark Dodge's Memorial Day weekend 10 sales.
Cars, but
with over $10 million available for car loans.
Did you catch that last bit? $10 million for loans? Turns out everybody's loosening the credit spigot, according to Kelly Blue Book senior analyst Alec Gutierrez.
Lenders have opened up their books to those with less than perfect credit.
There's a lot of pent-up demand for cars. George Magliano is a senior economist with IHS Automotive. He says the average U.S. car is 11 years old. Car-crazy consumers even flocked to GM showrooms in spite of its recall troubles. GM sales were up 13% over May of 2013. Magliano says most GM models are selling well.
Pickups and big sport utilities, okay, but now it started to feed through to their car lines.
Even Mother Nature smiled on the car industry. In some parts of the country, every weekend in May was sunny. Perfect car buying weather. In Washington, still driving my 10-year-old Honda. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Hey, new minivan here. Yay. All right, moving on. As the economy and politicians and lobbying groups get used to the EPA's new rules on greenhouse gas emissions from power plants that were announced yesterday, people are weighing in. The Washington Post and ABC News announced the results of a new poll. A big majority of Americans, both Democrats and Republicans, think federal limits on those power plant emissions are a good idea, even if it means higher electricity bills, which is a good thing because a lot of coal-fired power plants, the kind that turn out a lot of the cheapest energy we have, are already on their way out, thanks to rules that are already in place. Dan Weissman has that story.
Since 2010, coal plants that produced about a sixth of the country's coal-based electricity got slated for closure. About a third of them are already gone. And that's partly because other regulations, like rules about mercury emissions, meant old plants were going to need pricey upgrades. Christopher Knittle from MIT says the carbon rules announced this week could also have been a factor.
They shut down because of the rule that happened today, but they shut down 2 years ago because of the expectation of that rule.
Similarly, as more plants get pegged to close, the carbon rules won't necessarily be to blame every time.
It's going to be difficult to know exactly why a given power plant shut down. I think it's going to be a combination of cheap natural gas, the carbon rules, the mercury rules, and all the other environmental policies.
But the EPA projects coal will still produce 30% of our electricity in 2030. Here's Travis Miller from Morningstar.
Some of the new coal plants are very efficient and can emit relatively little for the amount of electricity that they produce.
Even with some older plants, closure may not be the best strategy for some utilities.
We don't see a whole lot of coal plant closures in states where you have options to lower the carbon intensity with other sources.
The new rules let states take credit for bringing in more wind and solar or for increasing energy efficiency. Older plants could keep running as part of that mix. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
I'd love to tell you there was lots going on Wall Street today, but that'd be a lie. We'd have the details when we do the numbers. This is election day in Syria, in parts of Syria more accurately. Voting is only happening in areas controlled by the government of President Bashar Assad. So he is expected, of course, to win easily in an election that the opposition has denounced as a sham. The BBC's Jeremy Bowen is in Damascus.
Now, that's the sound of thousands of small plastic Syrian flags rattling in the wind that's blowing in through the Hamidiya Souk here in the center of the old town, the old city of Damascus. And there are loads of people out shopping. It's a very bustling scene. You would never think for one moment that there's a war on. Now, Syria is very isolated at the moment, but historically, this is one of the great crossroads of the world. Where I'm in Damascus, especially, I'm very close to the entrance to the Umayyad Mosque, which was a place of worship a millennium or more before the coming of Islam in the 7th century. And over the years, the very, very many centuries, the people who've sustained a lot of what goes on here are the traders. So I'm going to talk to one man now who has a textile shop, and he's called Ziad. So what about the election?
Good. Good for the future. Now we have three...
Candidates,
yeah.
But Bashar's going to win.
The people decide.
Now, it's not like a Western-style electoral campaign. I haven't seen public meetings and press conferences and that kind of thing. But I went to see one of the other two names on the ballot paper, Hassan al-Nouri, man of 54, who's been in the government previously. And he says that he lost his place in the government because of his opposition to some of the things that Assad wasn't doing. Slowness of reform, this is before the war, cracking down on corruption and so on. And I said to him, look, how can you have a hope here, apart from anything else? There are thousands of Assad posters and almost none of you. And he accepted that for his supporters, it is quite hard to put up election posters.
When you have 2,500 posters and he has
like
25,000 posters,
at least. Cannot.
I came from a very big family. When I say big family, we're talking about more than 1,000 members of family. One single person from this family who is 100% believing in me would not have the guts to put a poster for me signing his name under.
Even your own relatives and your extended
and
family
friends, of
might
course,
be scared to put up posters of
not
you.
Not scared, reluctant. You know why they are reluctant? Because they never believed that there will be an election in Syria. And they suddenly having three candidates are competing each other for the president of the Syrian Arab Republic. Look at this big change now.
You know, the fact is that the main event in this country is still the war. That is still going on. Here in Damascus, you do hear the occasional thud of artillery outgoing, but nothing like you would have a year or 9 months ago, because they've pushed rebels away from the main center of Damascus in a way that they absolutely weren't able to do a year ago, for example. So at the moment, I'd say that there's a feeling of more security and stability coming off the regime, more confidence as well.
The BBC's Jeremy Bowen from Damascus. After 25 years on the radio, we got to thinking that it was time to branch out just a little bit. So we put together a live stage show that we're going to be taking around the country this summer and fall, talking about some of the numbers that seem to be so much at the heart of business and economic journalism. We call it How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Numbers.
You see them every day.
GDP.
Gosh, I don't know.
So inflation. What is it?
What does credit mean to you?
Numbers are fundamentally utilitarian. They tell us about the economic world around us. That applies for the whole economic world and our own little slices of it, too, because not only are there big systemic numbers like jobs and GDP, there are smaller but no less important numbers as well. And one of the most basic, you might actually call it one of the building blocks of the consumer economy, is our credit score. You've got one. I've got one. And so does Marketplace's Adrian Hill. Hey, Adrian.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so I'm going to put you on the spot here.
I'm ready.
I want to know your credit score.
No. Because, no way.
Why? Come on.
Absolutely
it's just a number.
Absolutely no
it's
way.
It's just a number.
Giving up my credit score, Kai, would tell you way, way too much about me. You'd probably be all judgy if I came in low, right?
Would not.
You'd be like, what's she been doing? And if I came in high, you'd be like, huh, that's
work. Pretty impressive.
Good work. You know, the power of the credit score is amazing. Here's John Altsheimer, a credit expert from CreditSesame.com.
It's not overblown to call the credit score one of the most important financial metrics that we now live with.
Apparently, people are even using credit scores to decide who to date. There's a dating website that promises to hook you up based on your number. And 800 to 850, that's marriage potential there. So me and my credit score, we are going to stay very private.
All right, I get it. No number. But how did it come to pass and why did it come to pass that we let this one number have so much control over our life?
It's a good question. And to answer it, let's go back to the 1960s. I refuse to
let you go. Here we are, 1960s. Dude, man, whoa, what?
Exactly right, guy. And you, in this scenario, are a banker.
Okay.
These two lovely people.
Hi, my name is Claudette, and I make $35,000 a year.
Hi, I'm Steve, and I make $35,000 a year.
They're looking for a loan.
Okay.
You've got money for one of them, so choose.
I want to see their credit scores.
You can't. There are no FICO scores yet. So, yeah, you got to choose without it.
How do I do that? I don't know how to do that.
So here's John again to give you some tips.
You almost always did business with a banker who was a friend of the family or someone with whom you golfed or someone with whom your parents worked or you went to the church with or in the Rotary Club with. And you would just sit down and discuss your needs, and they would make a decision based largely on a gut feel, if you will.
I am not picking. I want to go back to today. Can we do that? I'm just not going to pick.
Fine. We'll go back to today. So banking that way was pretty subjective in a way that left a lot of people out of the credit market based on gender, race, nationality, whether or not they were married. There were far less sophisticated credit reports that included information you could get from calling around and newspapers. And we're talking about things like drinking habits and personal cleanliness here. So the Fair Credit Reporting Act was passed in the 70s, and the FICO credit score that we all have today came along in the 1980s.
So what's the deal? I mean, yes, this is all better than me just winging it and going with my gut or a file of newspaper clippings, but we basically just learned to love this number? No?
We might want to cool our judge just a bit.
That's scary music.
You know, it's easy to fall in love with these numbers, to trust them. And a FICO credit score is better than our gut. It's standardized. The rules are set. But it's not perfect. For one, the FICO credit score doesn't include your salary, your employment history, whether or not you pay child support, whether or not you're in credit counseling. Here's Chi-Chi Wu. She's an attorney at the National Consumer Law Center. She calls credit scores a blunt instrument, especially considering we've just come through the financial crisis.
There were a lot of consumers who lost their jobs, and because they lost their jobs, they couldn't keep up with their bills. And they've had damaged credit records.
And a lot of those people are not the same kind of credit risk once they're back at work than the people who are just not paying their bills, right?
Exactly. Yeah. That's Wu's point. These scores just don't distinguish.
So how are you going to fix that? That doesn't seem fair.
Well, you can ask lenders to take those kind of extenuating circumstances more seriously. Also, Wu thinks credit scores probably don't need to look back as long as they do. Right now, negative information sticks to a report for 7 years.
I'm confused then, Adrian. What do I do? Do I love this number? Do I hate this number? What do I do?
You know, Kai, that's up to you. I'm not going to tell you who and what to love, but go in eyes open. Numbers can seem clean, perfect, less judgy, like they tell us everything we need to know. But they don't. They aren't. You gotta understand them in context and then decide how much power and love to give them.
Right.
Before we go, what's your credit score?
I'm so not telling you. I'm
Come
not telling.
On.
Adrian Hill. Thank you very much, Adrian.
You're welcome.
I'm still not telling. Two things before we go on. One, our live show tour dates for the rest of the year are on our website. It is, of course, marketplace.org. And number two, while you're there, check out our guest blogger and weekly rapper John Carney talking about his favorite number. It's a post called The Day the Market Broke. Coming up, not so much a career as a necessity.
I went to medicine not because really I had a lifelong passion for it, but because we came to this country, my family and I, in 1980, basically penniless and on welfare.
Author Khaled Husseini coming up, but first, Let's do the numbers. Wall Street took a breather from all those records today. The Dow Industrial is off a 10%, 21 points, 16,722 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ dipped less than a 10%. That's 3 points, 42.34. The S&P 500 was flat, finished at 19.24. Financials were mixed. Goldman Sachs took home a percent. J.P. Morgan Chase added 0.4%. We told you earlier about the car buying craze, or actually truck buying craze, if you dig into the numbers. GM accelerated 1%. Today, Ford shifted up 0.2%. Tesla, which makes only cars so far, picked up about 0.1% as well. Bond prices, well, they fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.59%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for April. The Senate Budget Committee holds a hearing on the impact of student loan debt on borrowers and the economy. And it's a day to run around town, or many miles. Tomorrow is National Running Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Take New Yorker magazine, the New Yorker magazine, rather, Architectural Digest, Gourmet, and Wired. You throw in a little Teen Vogue and Vanity Fair, and what do you got? Well, first of all, you have a partial list of the holdings of Condé Nast, the magazine publishing house. Also, though, an educational opportunity is what you got. The company is said to be partnering with colleges and universities to use its magazines as a framework for higher education. Marketplace's David Weinberg has the story.
Condé Nast already operates the Condé Nast College of Fashion and Design in London, which draws heavily on editors and writers from Vogue and other publications.
The access that we've got to lecturers, journalists who will be very good lecturers, and to the fashion and the decorating industry made it a very, very natural brand extension.
That's the president of Condé Nast International, Nicholas Coleridge, in a video on the college's website. This latest brand extension into education will be a partnership with University Ventures.
We are an investment firm focused on building highly innovative, high-quality university-level programs.
Daniel Pianco is managing director of University Ventures. He says it's too early to define exactly how the partnership will play out.
But we'll take the best minds from, you know, some of the top magazine and editorial talent and combine that with, you know, again, top-tier universities.
What will top magazine talent teach? Maybe how to write a captivating profile of a golfer with Golf Digest senior editor Peter Finch. Or maybe how to sell ads for chairs in architectural magazines. Whatever the class offerings may look like, David Longenecker, president of the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education, says the quality of any new program should be evaluated by an outside entity.
If it's this provider is also the evaluator, there's really the potential of the fox in the hen house. And so I think you really do need to have some capacity for external validation beyond the provider.
Condé Nast and University Ventures hopes to launch its new program by the fall of 2015. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Four years ago, back in 2010 to be precise, Michelle Obama helped get new rules put in place so that school kids would be able to have healthier lunches. Whole grains, more fruits and vegetables, less sodium, the basics, right? Now, however, there is something of a congressional food fight going on over those rules and how much they cost. Conrad Wilson reports.
$3.01. That's how much the federal government reimburses schools for lunch. And that's for everything. The food, the labor, and things like new kitchen equipment or repairs. But to get the money, schools need to follow the rules.
So the rules went into effect last year where you had to serve more fruits and vegetables.
A half cup of either with every meal, says Gita Greter Sweeney. She runs the nutrition program for Portland Public Schools in Portland, Oregon, where every day the district serves about 20,000 kids lunch. Starting in July, the guidelines get stricter. Nationwide, schools have to serve more whole grains and less sodium. Now Congress is debating whether to relax some of those rules, a move First Lady Michelle Obama and her supporters vowed to fight.
What we still believe is a big fight is holding steady on the sodium requirements and the whole grain requirements for school lunches.
Claire Benjamin is the managing director of Food Policy Action.
When we did these rules, we knew that some of these changes were going to be hard and it was going to take some time to implement.
To help school districts out, the feds offered to pay 6 cents more per lunch. But Greta Sweeney says to meet the new federal requirements, Portland Public Schools had to order more fruits and vegetables last year. A lot more.
I spent over $200,000 more in produce, but that 6 cents only covered about 60% of that.
Greta Sweeney says along with the requirement to serve healthier lunches came an unfortunate consequence. The district saw a dramatic increase in trash from students dumping the unwanted produce. One small school, she says, threw away 55 gallons of fruits and veggies every week.
In a number of our schools, we started composting because of this.
Greta Sweeney says the current mandates aren't working. She says kids should be able to choose which healthy foods they want.
They're not going to eat it necessarily just because you put it on their plate.
Before the new rules, the number of kids eating lunch in the Portland Public School District had been steadily increasing. Now, Greta Sweeney says the district is serving 3% fewer students school lunch compared to last year. Nationally, the USDA says nearly 1 million fewer kids are eating school lunch this year. Park Wilde is a food economist at Tufts University. He says it's hard to know if schools are just having a difficult time transitioning to the new rules or, more troubling, that kids today are more reluctant to eat healthy foods.
Everybody can sympathize with what it's like to be a school food service director reading all the small print on the new school meals requirements and thinking to him or herself, how am I going to do this?
But on the other hand, Wilde says, without rules, there would probably be districts that don't serve healthy meals. Congress is still debating what will happen with the school lunch program. But as of right now, schools will be serving even healthier and more expensive meals next fall. In Portland, I'm Conrad Wilson for Marketplace.
We're spending some time this week talking about numbers, what they mean and how we use them in the context of our economy, of course, but also in society. We've asked writers, people in the business of words, for their take. Today, author Khalid Husseini.
I love writing about family. I've always found family to be such a weird and powerful organism in which people behave in all the extreme ways that you can imagine. And being from Afghanistan, the whole notion of family is so central to one's identity, to how I understand myself, how I understand my world. I do have a background in science, and my training in that field as a physician has kind of come in handy in the writing of my books because I do write about illness. I write about pathology. I've found that I could tap into my years of training to kind of lend a kind of authority and veracity to those topics when I'm writing about them. My entire interest is in the artistic side of it. There's a whole economic side to writing, which I try to get involved with as little as possible. I think that once you begin to worry about who is meant to read your book, how many people will read them, how many copies you're going to sell, those kind of marketing, economic kind of issues, I think it can become a presence in the room with you. You can make money in writing, but the odds against it are pretty long. I went to medicine not because really I had a lifelong passion for it, although I had tremendous respect for the profession, but because we came to this country, my family and I, in 1980, basically penniless and on welfare. And so there was a part of me that really craved financial stability, and in part, that was the reason why I went to medicine. I really wasn't trying to craft a career in writing for myself. I really just wanted to write this book, and the career just kind of happened to me rather than my actually pursuing it. I've been fortunate enough that the things that have mattered to me and have felt urgent to me that I've written about have also resonated with other readers, and that has translated into, you know, very good book sales. But I'm very careful to think of that as a secondary issue, as difficult to believe as that may be, largely because I think numbers have a way of impinging and infiltrating your thought process, and that entire creative process is something that really needs to be unsullied.
Khalid Husseini's latest book, And the Mountains Echoed, is out in paperback. You can read an excerpt of it at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, which, yeah, you know, I'm sure this is going to work. The Secret Service wants somebody to invent a piece of software that will, and this is a quote from the work order, detect sarcasm and false positives in social media. As in, if you're a teenager on Twitter and you threaten to blow up a plane because you're, I don't know, a teenager and bored and stupid, this would in theory prevent the FBI from knocking on your door in pursuit of said bored teenager. You've got less than a week to go if you're up to the challenge of creating this piece of analytics. Next Monday is the deadline. What could possibly go wrong? Oh, I don't know. Wait, was that sarcasm? Maybe. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow off about a 10%, 21 points. The NASDAQ off less than a 10%, 3 points. The S&P 500 pretty much flat. Nancy Fargali is the senior producer of Special Projects. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Escher on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin and Shay Huffman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.